Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum. We love Thursday open forums. It's a lot of fun, and you are welcome to call 888-318-7884 if you have a question about the Catholic faith. And talking with you is one of the reasons we love open forum. We get wonderful guests like Trent Horn this hour on open forum, and also the groovy music plays on Thursday. So at some point during the show today, we'll get the groovy music. Trent Horn is an apologist here at Catholic Answers, a renowned speaker and teacher and pro-life activist, and he's the author of books such as Persuasive Pro-Life Why We're Catholic, and then the most recent of the Trent books is Things the Saints Never Said.
What the Saints?
I knew it. Said. I knew I was going to mess it up. I knew I was.
It's because that my book is about misquoting the saints, and so now you got to misquote me.
No, I'm just lame. But have you seen my T-shirt, Trent? Can you see it? I got a really cool T-shirt on it with a very, very handsome head on it. A face right in the middle.
Please don't rub my face.
Oh, sorry. I can pat you on the head. Look, I'm patting you on the head.
I'm still getting used to that. Yes, for all of our radio listeners, you and I, for our Facebook Live people, I've been asked to sport this as well. It is the T-shirt premium subscribers to the people who subscribe. I think it's... silver level and up, get a free T-shirt when you subscribe to my Council of Trent podcast.
And it's a nice T-shirt as well. So, but you got to tell them where to go for the Council of Trent podcast.
Yeah. To learn more, and if you'd like to subscribe and get your own T-shirt, it's TrentHornPodcast.com. I do general and premium episodes every week about how to better understand, explain, and defend our faith. So it's your little sit-down time each week with me on all kinds of different subjects. And if you subscribe at a gold level or higher, you can actually suggest topics for me to cover and questions for me to answer.
Our number here today, 888-318-7884. Somebody online just asked if I'm wearing a Bob Saget T-shirt. That's not right. Sorry, Trent.
I think there's a lot of other celebrities I think I look like before Bob Saget.
Well, this is a cartoon of you, though.
No, it is a caricature.
It's a caricature, right. And
an animation, yes.
And Full House has
millions and
millions. I still
think it looks more like Fred Savage or Shia LaBeouf than Bob Saget.
Oh, it does kind of look like Shia LaBeouf a little bit. Yeah, that's true.
There you go.
I think your cartoon hair is curlier than your real hair.
Depends how long I let it grow. Oh, depends how long. You never know with that thing.
I want to be a cartoon someday. Trent, we have like every single line full. Do you feel ready to answer questions, or are you just going to goof around all day?
Little column A, little column B.
All right, let's go to column B. Victor in Greenville, North Carolina, you are on with Trent Horn, who is a man and a T-shirt now. Your question for him.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Happy to.
My question is, what is compatibilism? And what's the Catholic view on it?
Okay. Have you ever heard the term, like the context it's being used in, or you just heard the word once and were wondering what it means?
I try to learn it. To me, it seems like it's both determinism and free will.
Yeah, it is. So compatibilism is a view on the question of the relationship between free will and determinism. So the question is, essentially, if determinism is true, can people have free will? And now the philosophers and theologians assign different meanings to these terms. So determinism basically means that our actions are caused by something outside of ourselves. For atheistic determinists, now there's different kinds of determinists. There are materialistic or non-religious determinists, people who would say, look, all the universe is just matter colliding in motion, And so everything you do is determined by what the molecules and atoms in your body and outside of you did in the moments leading up to your decision. So they would say everything is fixed. Things could not have been different. If you look back at a past decision you made, it could not have been different because it's decided by all the molecules and atoms in your brain. You don't really get to choose anything. That's one kind of determinism. Another kind of determinism is theological determinism. These are people who believe that God knows the future and he knows everything because he determines what happens. We find this in particular forms of Calvinism, that Calvinists would hold that because God is sovereign, he determines everything that happens. And some will go so far as to say that God causes us not just to do good, but also to do evil. Everything that happens, both good, evil, and morally neutral, is caused by God. So there's non-religious determinism and theological determinism. And free will, of course, is the idea. And of course, people define free will in different ways to try to have their cake and eat it too. But free will traditionally is defined as the ability to act without being determined by some kind of something outside of oneself, the ability to choose, to not be constrained by outside forces. So though that's free will and determinism. So the question is, can you have free will if determinism is true? Now, incompatibilists will say, no, you can't. If determinism is true, then you don't have free will. So there are people like Sam Harris, the atheist Sam Harris. He's an incompatibilist. He says, look, if the world is determined by material laws, there's no free will. Free will is just an illusion. Most religious people I know, most Christians, would actually agree with Harris and agree with other atheistic incompatibilists and say, yeah, if determinism is true, we don't have free will. But guess what? We do have free will. So determinism's not true. Those are the incompatibilists. Now, compatibilists will say, well, actually, you can have your cake and freely choose to eat it too. A compatibilist will say, even if our actions are determined by God or they're determined by molecules in motion, even if they are determined, we still have free will. And usually in order to accomplish this, they'll redefine free will. They'll say, well, free will means that you are able to do what you want. So even if you couldn't have done anything differently because you're determined, as long as you wanted to do it, you're free. So the compatibilists will say, yeah, even if you're determined, hey, as long as you want it, if the molecules in your brain or God causes you to want to do this, you're still free. I would say that the Catholic tradition, if we look at how the church defines things like freedom, would make it very difficult, if not impossible, to hold a compatibilism. The Catechism defines freedom this way. It's in paragraph 1731. It says, freedom is the power rooted in reason and will to act or not to act, to do this or that, and so to perform deliberate actions on one's own responsibility. So when we read in the Catechism and other Catholic documents, freedom is defined more so in the ability to do or not do certain things, not merely to do what we want. And so if we are caused to do this or that by something outside of us, then it would seem we are determined and we're not really free. So the church would hold that man has free will. We are able to, for example, choose to sin or not sin. We are able to choose to accept or reject God's offer of salvation. And because we can freely choose to do things, we can be held morally accountable for those choices. I would say that that's a severe problem in both for atheists who deny free will and for Christians like Calvinists who deny free will. Because look, if you can't freely choose to do something, if you're caused to do something by something outside of you, how can you be morally responsible for your actions? Any more than, you know, if Darren walks in on Cy and, you know, picks up his hands and flails them around and you know, cuts off the computer and the calls, that's not Cy's fault. He's being determined. He's flailing around. You're freely flailing around right now, Cy.
Darren was doing that.
Oh, okay. The Darren made me do it.
Yeah.
So that would be, I guess, to wrap all of that up. Before I could go a little bit more with that, but is that helpful for now, Victor, to understand compatibilism?
Yeah, that's helpful because it did sound confusing to me. How you explained it, I kind of figured it was one of those try to have your cake and eat it too.
That's right. So just to summarize, the question is, if we are determined by things outside of us that make us do certain things, do we have free will? incompatibilists will say, no, we don't. There's determinists like Sam Harris who say, yeah, if you're caused by something, you don't have free will, it's an illusion. I would say that most Christians even would say, no, we're not determined. We can choose. We have free will. We're not determined. The compatibilists will say, look, as long as you can, you want to do something, even if God or molecules make you do it, you're still, you still have free will. But I think they can only achieve that by redefining free will into something that it really is not. So I hope that that's helpful. And a good resource that covers this and other related topics would be Edward Faser's book, Philosophy of Mind. And I think that would be a good, because a lot of this deals with the mind and cognition and what we're able to choose or not to. So that might be a good book to read on the subject. And thank you very much for calling in.
Thanks, Victor. We have to take a break. We'll be right back with more Trent Horn, Open Forum Day here on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Hi, this is Trent Horn. Did you know that you can have me and other Catholic Answers speakers headline your next conference or parish event? Go to CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com to get all the information you need to book one of our dynamic speakers today. That's CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com.
If only evangelization was easy. But the truth of the matter is that most of the time, it's not. Talking about the Catholic faith is enough of a challenge even before dealing with the roadblocks that keep people from listening with an open mind. Apologist Carlo Broussard recognized that as he wrote Prepare the Way, a guide to step-by-step strategies that readers can use to break down those barriers, barriers to the very existence of God and religious truth, barriers to basic Christian beliefs, and barriers to the distinctive teachings and claims of the Catholic Church. Don't let obstacles get in your way. Learn how to overcome them. Order your copy of Prepare the Way today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Interested in visiting Catholic Answers? If you live in or plan to visit beautiful Southern California, we'd love to have you come by for a tour. You can meet our apologists and staff, visit our chapel, and watch the broadcast of Catholic Answers Live. To arrange a tour, call us at 619-387-7200 or email us at visit@catholic.com.
St. John Paul II stated that, for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation.
So we know we're called, but how do we do it?
St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Call now with your question. 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Our guest this hour is author, speaker, and apologist Trent Horn. Trent's latest book is Stuff That the Saints Never Got Around to Saying. Is that the correct
More or less.
Oh, you're just giving up on me now. Okay.
No, I need to respect your cultural adaptation of my book.
Oh, so. Wow. That is very millennial of you. Thank you so much for being so millennial with me. Let's go to Michael in Lafayette, Indiana, watching on Facebook. Thanks for watching on Facebook, Michael. Your question for Trent Horn.
Hello. Peace be with you.
And with your spirit.
Jesus Christ outright rejects the food laws in Mark chapter 7. So is it reasonable to assume that these food laws from the Old Testament are more human than they are divine?
What do you mean when you say that Jesus outright rejects the food laws in Mark 7?
He says that it's not what you put into your mouth that defiles you, but what comes from your heart that defiles you.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, what Jesus is talking about here in Mark chapter 7 is the purity requirements and whether they still are required and whether there's something that the people of God is imposing on the people of God in order to keep them pure. it still is something that was true that, yeah, what you eat doesn't change the nature of your soul, for example. However, God can require you to perform certain behaviors, for example, to act in certain ways. And so you can incur punishment or sin by disobeying God if one of those requirements could even include something that's dietary. So the question becomes, are these dietary laws, when are they binding for the people of God? And Jesus, in coming to atone for the sins of the world and making the grace of God available for all people, is expanding God's grace beyond the Jewish people. He's beginning with the Jewish people. He's born into a Jewish family, born into God's chosen people. But throughout the New Testament, Jesus is also going out to the Gentiles. And eventually, the gospel will be proclaimed to all nations. And so in order to bring more people into the family of God, in order to bring more people into the new covenant, what Jesus is saying here and what will be carried out through the church is the understanding that the kosher laws, the Hebrew word kashrut, were only binding upon the people in the Old Testament. They were required so that the Israelites could be distinguished from their Canaanite neighbors, that the way they worshiped, the way they dressed, and in particular the way they ate, were something that set them apart from their pagan neighbors to prevent this kind of pagan cultural assimilation. However, while these kosher laws were good at keeping the Jews apart from non-Jews so that they wouldn't be taken over by these other pagan cultures, they also would keep other pagans, other people away from God. And so now, in the fullness of time when Jesus had become man, at the time where the Jewish people were not facing the same threats that they did earlier in the Old Testament, Jesus was able to reveal that these kosher laws were no longer binding upon the people of God. And this is what we see in Mark chapter 7, later, and this is reaffirmed in Acts chapter 15, to see what God does require of people and what he does not. And if you'd like a little bit more on that, we've got a few articles actually on just that subject at our website at Catholic.com. So if you want to go deeper in there, I would check that out.
Thanks, Michael. Let's go to Ken in Bismarck, North Dakota, listening on EWTN. Ken, your question for Trent Horn.
Yes, I'm just wondering about the history of the Roman collar that priests wear. How long has that been around? Mm-hmm. And like the symbolism behind it, and who designed it, or anything?
Sure.
Yeah, okay. Trent, the Roman collar. We see it, but we never think about where it came from. Where did it come from?
Sure. And clerical collars, you can find them outside of Catholic clerics. You can see them among Anglicans, other Protestants. Different ministers will wear collars, and there's different theories about where they developed. Catholic priests probably began wearing them as just a part of fashion that developed in Italy, I think in the 16th and 17th centuries, that it was a collar that would come up from the undershirt over a cassock that was being worn. Later, Protestants would adapt this, and the more traditional removable collar, I think, was developed by Scottish Protestants in the early 19th century. And so, this is just a way of that clerics and those who have holy orders, those who assume the title of pastor or cleric, have, in any religion really, have always dressed distinctly to identify that they are separate in calling and mission from the laity. It's very, very rare in religions for the leaders of religions, for priests, pastors, whoever it may be, to not be distinguished in some special way from the laity. And so this is just one way that, you know, before the collar, there were vestments, other things that were worn. This is just another fashion that developed over time. But oftentimes fashions that develop, symbolism can be drawn out of it upon deeper meditation. So there's a few different symbolisms for the collar that priests wear, the Roman collar. One is the idea that the collar represents bondage to God, like being a slave, like slaves would wear collars in the ancient world. So St. Paul himself, in many Bibles, the word servant is used, and servants and slaves are pretty similar classes in ancient Rome. But we think of servants like, you know, like a butler, like Jeffrey from the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air or something. But when Paul says he's a servant of Christ, he's not somebody that goes there for great pay. The word is doulos, slave. So Paul says, I am a slave for Christ. And so some priests will see the collar as being, you know, I'm enslaved, but to God, to Christ, to serve him in everything that I do. So that's one. Others just signifies, you know, this distinction from lady, as I said earlier. And I've heard some people say that because it can sometimes be uncomfortable to wear around the neck, it can be a kind of form of penance to offer up each day for the vocation one has chosen. So that would be the general understanding of the Roman collar, at least from what I've heard.
Ken, thank you very much. There are a load of calls, so I'm just moving quickly through them. So Trent will have a chance to talk to as many folks as he can. Linda in Houston, Texas, you are on with Trent Horn. Your question, Linda. Hey, Linda. We'll come back to you, Linda. Hang on. We'll come back to you. I know you probably had errands to run. Angel in Anaheim, California, watching on Facebook. Angel in Anaheim, that's the perfect place for someone named Angel to live.
Yes, it is.
I wonder if people around the country know that that's where the Angels play, but I don't know. It's a baseball team. Angel, your question for Trent.
So the question I have for Trent is, how would you answer, or how can you help me answer, when someone says that the church is misogynist because they don't let women be ordained, or maybe because, you know, the Bible says that women have to be subject to men mm-hmm. or to the husband?
Yeah, sure.
How can you lead me to that?
Yeah. And those are two separate issues. One would be an understanding of Bible difficulties. There are passages, that's the passage in Ephesians chapter 5. That's the one where I call it the elbowing passage, because when people sit in church and it's read and it says, wives be subject to your husbands as Christ, wives be subject to your husbands, the husbands will elbow their wives. But then in Ephesians chapter 5, St. Paul also says, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. And Christ demonstrated his love for the church by dying for the church, by offering his very life for the church, everything that he was offering in an excruciating death on the cross. So then the wives get to elbow the husband's back when they hear that. So I think this is to understand that what Pope St. John Paul II, I think he talked about this in Mulieris Dignitatum on the dignity of women, that here when it's talking about wives being subject to their husbands, it's not for them to be mere doormats and their husbands are tyrannical, but to allow their husbands to be spiritual leaders, not ones, once again, that are tyrants, but ones that can imitate Christ and plot out a plan for the family to lead them to holiness in cooperation with their wives. So when we see words like submission, to submit under, others have drawn out from this the idea that submission is to be under the mission of your spouse, of your husband. And so this complementary nature here is to see that men and women, husbands and wives, offer different things to marriage. And I think that what's unfortunate is that in the world we live in, people think that if two things are different, then they are going to be unequal. And so that's why you have this strange thing happening now with gender theory, where anyone who says, well, men are different than women, especially if people say that men, for example, are better at certain skills or understanding certain fields, then that's just you'll just hear an uproar. What's funny is if you say things like, well, women tend to have better verbal skills and understanding of verbal relationships and understanding relationship cues, things like that. If you talk about women, where women cognitively excel over men, there's much less uproar that happens. So people will try to say that there are really no differences between men and women, that they're all socially conditioned, that we condition little boys to act like boys, girls to act like girls, and that men and women, there are really no differences between us. Even biologically, those don't matter. And so in order to preserve the equality of men and women, well, we have to say that there really is no difference. But that's silly. Of course there are differences. I mean, you even see this in other animals. When you take chimpanzees, little boy and girl chimpanzees, and give them toys, the girl chimpanzees play with the dolls, and the boy chimpanzees take the trucks and bash them together. And we're not socializing chimpanzees. This shows deep down, maleness and femaleness are real, and they have differences to complement one another. And so what God teaches us through scripture and tradition is that men and women complement one another with different, though equal, roles, different, though equal. And Christ has called for men to serve in the role of being priest. And the church does this. You can say, well, look, the church does this because Jesus did not call women. He could have. He bucked cultural trends. He associated with women. But he only called men to be apostles. And so you can say, look, the church doesn't hate women. We're just doing what Jesus did. We're imitating Jesus. I'd also add that another theological reflection from this is that Christ became human, and specifically, he became man. That's important to Christ's identity as a human. And so when the priest stands in the person of Christ, I don't know how it would work for a female priest to be in the person of Christ and say, this is my body, when she has a female body, not a male body. So is that kind of a helpful start?
Yes, yes, it is. My last kind of question or kind of adding to that would be, how can we say or how can we help someone that still thinks that the church sees women as less than a man?
I would here's my quick rejoinder to that. You can ask them, what creature in all of the universe has the highest place of all of God's creation? What creature has the highest place? It's a woman. It's a woman, our Blessed Mother. Ask them, how many churches do you know? How many churches do you know around you? Who are they named after? Usually, it's a female saint. So the church doesn't hate women. The church, the Catholic Church, exalts women right and left. So that might be something to bring up.
Oh, sorry. We'll be right back after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
Can you trust the basis of the Christian faith? The Christian faith is under constant attack today in numerous ways, but the attack that does the most damage is the one that asks a deceptively simple question. What if your faith is based on a myth? The skeptics come with arguments to cast doubt in numerous ways, often attacking the reliability of the New Testament and the Gospels. And the sad news is that most people don't know how to answer these charges. The good news is that there are answers to each and every one of them. Good, solid answers. That's why Catholic Answers Studios has just released Jimmy Akin's new DVD, The Dawn of Christian History. With his characteristic wit and passion as a master storyteller, Jimmy takes you through an exciting detective story that reveals how history supports the Christian faith. Order your copy of The Dawn of Christian History today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
As the legend goes, the Protestant Reformation began when Martin Luther nailed a list of his grievances with the Catholic Church to the door of All Saints Church in Wittenberg, Germany. But do you know the whole story? In Catholic Answers' brand new documentary, The Protestant Revolution, you will hear from top apologists Tim Staples, Jimmy Akin, Carla Broussard, Trent Horn, and Steve Weidenkopf as they expose the errors of Martin Luther and of the other so-called reformers. This DVD will give you a clearer understanding of our Protestant brothers and sisters, and you will be better equipped to engage them about what separates us and about what unites us. Order your copy of The Protestant Revolution today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting shop.catholic.com, or by asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
EWTN, helping people grow in their love and understanding of God.
I just wanted to thank you for your show. It's made such a huge difference in my faith life. Because if you don't know why you're doing things and you're just going through the motions, it's totally pointless. But if you know why, it's infinitely meaningful. So you really helped me make a 180.
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Yep. That's right. There it is. Groovy music. Thanks for the groovy music, Nick. Groovy music means it's Thursday. It's open forum, and we're having fun. 888-318-7884 is the number. I am Cy Killett, your host. Our guest this hour is Trent Horn, and we just have a stack of questions from callers about the Catholic faith. And that's what, oh, by the way, I don't know if I've mentioned this enough today. You don't have to be Catholic to call. Non-Catholics are more than welcome. Just dial 888-318-7884, and we'll do our very best to get you on with Trent. We go now to Linda in Houston, Texas. Linda, you are on with Trent Horn. Are you there, Linda?
Yes, I am, and thank you for taking my call.
Happy to.
And I have a question, actually, a couple. What happened is, I have my sons, I baptized them in Catholic Church because I'm Catholic, I'm Italian and all that, and also they took their first communion in a Catholic Church and all of that. But then once they started going to, in middle school, they started meeting some friends, and they put them in a non-denominational church, pretty large non-denominational church here in Houston, Texas. And they liked it so much that they kept on going there. And I didn't think anything about it until recently that I noticed that they don't desire to come to a Catholic church and take the sacraments. They say, oh, it's not necessary to take the sacraments. And so they start liking the non-denominational church, this large non-denominational church. How can I do to get them back to the Catholic Church?
Right, sure. Linda, how old are your sons?
Well, now they are, one is 23 and one is 24.
Oh, okay. So they're not, because this started like in middle school. They met all these people,
yeah.
But they're not middle schoolers anymore. They're adults.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
But so, I just now realized the damage because I didn't think much of it. And I said, well, because on Christmas and Easter, we were going to Catholic Church and they took the communion. But now that I really want to go every Sunday, they said, no, we're going to
sure.
the other.
Well, Linda, I think that, and once again, this is, thank you for sharing the story, because this, I hope, will be a cautionary tale for other parents who are listening that, you know, you want your children to be around good people. And oftentimes, you know, our Protestant brothers and sisters, they're very good people, very virtuous. You know, they understand the Bible very well. At least they recite it very well. And, you know, it can be good, wholesome fun. We want our children to be a part in that. These are, you know, people who aren't going to be doing drugs or bad activities. And so we think, well, what's the harm? But the problem is, the more they're not just going to be playing football and eating pizza and watching movies, they're also going to have conversations. They're going to be taught things at a Protestant youth group or a Protestant church that contradict our faith, that contradict what we believe. So I think that what's important here is to first provide that foundation, do whatever you can to find other children for your own children. Who are Catholic, who are within youth groups, Life Teen, whatever it may be, to have that wholesome fun, but in a Catholic environment. Now, Linda, if in your case you say, well, you know, they're grown up, they're adults, they're 23, 24, they think, I don't have to go to church, what do I do? Here, I think what you have to do is always be willing to offer the olive branch, always have that invitation, and it's going to be kind of a slow and steady path to have conversations to help them come back into the church. So offering them, hey, come, I'd really enjoy if you could come with me whenever you want. The door is always open. I'd love for you to join me when you're home, when you're in town. Also there to offer gifts that they might find to be interesting, like a book on the Catholic Church. My book, Why We're Catholic, might be a nice read for them. You can say, hey, here's a book that, you know, maybe there's things you heard about the Catholic Church that you disagree with that aren't actually true. You might want to recommend my book, Why We're Catholic, because I wrote it for people like your sons who aren't practicing their faith anymore to read. I wrote it just for them. And then finally, asking them a lot of questions like, you know, well, how do you choose a church to go to? It's non-denominational. Which church do you pick? How do you know it's the right church? Do you think Jesus started a church? Who founded that church you're a part of? Because it was founded by somebody 10, 20, 30 years ago, and that came from a church that was founded 100 years ago. Only the Catholic Church can trace its founding all the way back to Jesus and the apostles. And so shouldn't we be faithful to the church that Jesus founded? So you kind of have these conversations, be open, inviting them, give them little books and gifts to sow the seeds, and then ask these little questions about what church they choose and why in particular they have problems with the Catholic Church. And then you got to go get the answers. So I can't give you an easy answer. It's just kind of a process. But I think it's one I'll ask our listeners to pray for you as you go through. So is that a helpful start?
Yes, I did not realize. It just slipped to me. I did not realize the damage because I always thought, oh, don't worry, they're going to come back to Catholic. We're going to take the communion. But now it's like, no, we like that one better. And
sure.
So it really damaging if you don't raise them all the way without interruption into the Catholic Church. I really regret to have done that.
Sure, I understand. And Linda, why don't hang up. I want you to stay on the line. Just to make sure we get this good resource to you and your sons, I'm going to have the call screener get your address, and we will send you a copy of my book, Why We Are Catholic. And I think that could be very helpful for you to read first and then to pass it on to one of your sons. So stay on the line, and our call screener will get your address to send you a copy of Why We're Catholic.
Thanks, Linda. Let's go to Nick in Salt Lake, Utah, listening on EWTN. Nick, your question for Trent Horn.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. It's just a quick follow-up to Jimmy's act of contrition question.
Yes.
If I say an act of contrition and have that and as perfect in my heart as I can before Mass, but I don't have the opportunity to go to confession, am I okay to receive communion if I know and I've done that, and I also know that later that day or the next day I will be able to go to confession? Or is that something that only the priest can authorize you to do, or what do you recommend?
Sure. This is covered in the Code of Canon Law in paragraph 916, and this is what it says. So I think all the elements are important to break down. It says, a person who is conscious of grave sin is not to celebrate Mass, so that's the priest, or receive the body of the Lord without previous sacramental confession, unless there is a grave reason and there is no opportunity to confess. In this case, the person is to remember the obligation to make an act of perfect contrition, which includes the resolution of confessing as soon as possible. So what does this mean? Well, if you make an act of perfect contrition, now people often confuse this. They say, if I did a perfect act of contrition, am I okay? No. It's not saying the act of contrition perfectly. It's being perfectly contrite. And what that would mean is that you are sorrowful for sin because of a love for God and how sin damages your relationship with God. Your sorrow is done out of a love of God. Imperfect contrition is sorrow that arises out of your punishment. So, you know, it's like the kid who, you know, is sorry because he doesn't want to get grounded. Imperfect contrition. He's sorry because he hurt his parents' feelings. Perfect contrition. So if you make an act of perfect contrition, you're sorrowful for your sins because out of a love for God, then you can either receive the Eucharist or celebrate Mass if there is a grave reason for you to do so and there's no opportunity to confess. So I would say, let's say for a priest, if he's in a state of mortal sin, he may have a grave reason because, you know, people have come to the church now to celebrate Mass and no one can substitute for him. So he might have to make an act of perfect contrition to fulfill this just obligation to those who have come to receive the sacraments. Also, same for receiving the Eucharist if you're in danger of death, for example. Or there's other situations, for example, that if you are, let's say maybe you're at a wedding, you're the bride or the groom or one of the people who's an element of public focus and people know you're Catholic, and you worry that if you don't receive communion, people will think that, you know, you're in mortal sin. Oh, you know, what'd this person do? Oh, and you might worry that you could make scandal or hurt your own reputation. It's possible there that could arise to a level of gravity. But if it's merely that, well, I haven't had a chance to go to confession yet and I could always go in a few days or a week, I'm not sure that I don't know if that would really qualify as a grave reason to receive the Eucharist. I would say that if we are in a state of mortal sin, we should do our best to be mindful, as we read in 1 Corinthians 11, about discerning the body and blood of the Lord. And it should the receiving it in grave sin by making a act of perfect contrition should only be done if there's a grave reason to do so. So does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. What I mostly run into is if you go to a parish where the priest doesn't offer the sacrament of confession often, and if you go knowing, hey, this is a time he's usually there, but he happens to not be doing it again or something, and it's like, well, I went early before Mass in hopes he was going to be there, and he's not. Yeah. I don't, you know. But,
yeah, and I think,
you know,
that's something where I would recommend talking to a spiritual director about and praying. But I do think that there should be the Lord should have some understanding that if a person has made every reasonable effort to avail themselves of the sacrament of confession and it's simply not possible, and perhaps they worry about their own spiritual welfare because they're not receiving the Eucharist, that might be something to consider. But I would say even in those cases, you never do harm in not receiving the Eucharist. I mean, you only have to receive the Eucharist once a year. I would recommend talking to a spiritual director or a priest about those particular incidents when they arise. And I, in these situations, would usually just err on the side of caution. So always remembering that God is merciful, but to still be mindful of our sins and what they do to our relationship to him. So I hope that's helpful.
And thank you, Nick. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Trent Horn Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
We'll be right back with more great answers from Trent today on Catholic Answers Live.
God helps those who help themselves. Preach the gospel always. When necessary, use words. Sayings like these are such a part of tradition that we assume they come from the Bible, the saints, or famous Christian writers, even though nobody can seem to place their origin. By sheer repetition, they have acquired a halo of truth. In What the Saints Never Said, Trent Horn takes over 40 of these well-known but actual dubious sayings and attempts to track them to their true source. The result? He finds some that are close to what was really said, many that were misattributed or twisted beyond their original meaning, and more than a few that were just plain made up. By setting the record straight, Trent roots out theological errors that can lead us away from Christian truth and offers authentic quotes from Scripture, saints, and scholars that will draw you closer to that truth. Get your copy of What the Saints Never Said today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Looking for an on-fire Catholic speaker for your event? Catholic Answers speakers will inform and inspire your audience to grow in their Catholic faith. For more information on booking a Catholic Answers speaker, visit CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com today.
How would you like to have the very best and faithful Catholic content delivered daily to your inbox? Articles, video, and audio, apologetics, current events, and commentary. The Catholic Answers Daily Newsletter includes all that and more, and it's easy to sign up. Just visit Catholic.com today and look for the newsletter sign-up box on the front page. Keep up with what's happening in the Catholic Church with today's leading apologists, speakers, and writers delivered daily to your inbox. Catholic Answers Daily. Sign up today at Catholic.com and get better at defending your faith one day at a time.
Call now with your question. 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're heading up towards the top of the hour, and it is open forum, and lots of people have questions, so I'm just going to move through the questions as quickly as I can, give Trent Horn, our guest this hour, a chance to get to as many as he can before we have to go for the afternoon. We go now to Brian in Cleveland, Ohio, listening on 1260 The Rock. Brian, your question for Trent.
My question for Trent is this. I'm wondering how you deal with, speak with, perhaps even debate Catholic friends who subscribe to the notion of relativism, and it usually applies to that they're lax with regard to abortion, euthanasia, to gay marriage, you know, and the belief that everybody's entitled to their own truth. And I say that It doesn't matter if you've got 1,000 people with 1,000 different truths, they're just one truth, and that's the way it is. But they say, well, it's not me that would do these things, but I think people have the right to make those decisions, and how should I respond to that?
Okay, so let me see, Brian, if I understand your question. You're saying you have friends who are Catholic. Now, they say, make sure I understand you correctly, they say they wouldn't have an abortion, they wouldn't commit euthanasia or celebrate same-sex marriage, but they can't tell other people that they aren't allowed to do those things. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Is it correct? Yes?
Yes, yes.
Okay, good. Well, I think what I would do is just try to pick a moral issue where they would agree that we ought to tell other people that they can and cannot do certain things. Because it seems to me that what they're concerned about is imposing aspects of their religion upon other people. And you could say, well, I'd understand that. I mean, I wouldn't want someone compelling me to worship the God of Islam, for example, and to deny Jesus when I should be allowed to worship Jesus. That's my freedom to do that. We should have religious freedom. So you can say, yeah, there's certain aspects of our faith we should not impose on others, But there are other aspects of our faith that are not just divinely revealed truths. They're truths of natural law. They're things that any person, any reasonable person, when they think about right and wrong and good and evil, should just know. And if they don't know, they have some kind of cognitive defect then. The fact is, all people deep down should know these basic moral truths and ought to abide by them. Reasonable people should, and good people should do what they can to stop evil people from doing these things. So I would just try to pick the most uncontroversial examples you can think of. To ask them, look, the Catholic Church says that genocide is wrong, says that human trafficking is wrong, that rape is wrong, that, you know, picking examples that almost everybody agrees, yeah, they're wrong. There's some people who might think, well, they're not wrong, or they're not wrong in my case. Don't you think we ought to, as a church, as reasonable people, pass laws to protect innocents from these kinds of harms? That's another great question, actually, you can bring to them and say, look, do you think, because they're worried about imposing our view on people who disagree, but the problem is you pick abortion, euthanasia, even same-sex marriage, these other people are imposing things too. Because you can say, look, shouldn't we protect unborn children from being imposed upon by the violence of abortion? Shouldn't we protect the elderly and disabled from being imposed upon by the threat of euthanasia or assisted suicide? So you could say to them, look, everybody, even with so-called same-sex marriage, somebody's going to impose and say, this is what marriage is, everybody's got to believe that. Even if it's the other side, they say it's just two people, it doesn't have to be a man and woman. Well, they're going to they have imposed that view on others, and people who disagree, people who teach different things about sexuality and sexual orientation. In California, it's possible that books that advocate that one ought to change their sexual behavior could be banned. People who conduct seminars on these subjects, like myself, could be the subject of criminal penalties. So I would just bring them to that. Try to pick uncontroversial examples of things that everybody knows are wrong. Some people disagree. Shouldn't we persuade or at least pass laws to stop those grave moral wrongs? And then our abortion, euthanasia, redefining marriage, are those grave moral wrongs? And then take the imposing angle, but turn it to the victims, like the unborn child, the elderly, the disabled, children, when marriage is redefined so they don't have a natural relationship with their father and mother. So that might be, if they're worried about imposing, try the innocent victim that abortion and all these other things imposes on those innocent victims. So are those two helpful strategies when these topics come up?
That is helpful. I guess I took the wrong tack today because I brought up the issue of that poor toddler, Alfie Evans, and I said, mm-hmm. You're for this, and this is what it looks like. This is what it looks like.
Yes.
And I guess that was the wrong way to approach it.
Well, the problem is they may say, with the case of Alfie Evans, well, I think the parents are cruel and the state should just let this child die naturally. But he's not dying naturally. Actually, he's surviving without a ventilator. And that's a whole different case. But that's why it's important when we engage in moral reasoning with people. Like when I talk about abortion, that's why you'll hear me with callers on this show. They'll say, you know, I think abortion should be right because some women are too poor. I'll say, well, do you think a woman who lives in poverty should be able to kill a 2-year-old? And I pick that because it's uncontroversial. Almost everybody agrees it's wrong. Okay, so we agree we should make laws to keep 2-year-olds from being killed who are in poverty. Why not for 2-month-olds in the womb? So when we engage in moral reasoning, it always kind of runs the same way. We have disputed issue X, you know, abortion, homosexuality, contraception, whatever it may be. Disputed issue X. You and I disagree. The Alfie Evans case. We disagree on this. Well, let's talk about case Y. Undisputed case Y. You and I, my dear friend, my opponent in this discussion, we agree in case Y what to do. Don't kill 2-year-olds. Don't euthanize children with mild cognitive defects. We agree. But guess what? Case Y is actually similar. Undisputed case Y is similar to disputed case X. Since we know what to do in the undisputed case of killing toddlers or euthanizing people with Down syndrome, whatever it may be, if those principles carry over to where we disagree, like abortion or euthanasia or marriage, well, guess what? Those principles will carry the day, and you should actually agree with me. That's kind of just how you reason morally. It's a path that it's an argument by analogy I find to be helpful, and one I'd recommend in yours and everyone else's future discussions on different subjects like that.
Thank you very much for that call, Brian. We're going to move on now to Dustin in Windsor, Ontario, Canada. Dustin, thanks for listening in Canada. Your question for Trent Horn.
Hey, guys. Appreciate you taking my call. Love the show. I've been in discussion with Tim Staples about possibly being a guest one day, former Muslim and Protestant convert, so I got that on my bucket list.
Wait, former Muslim and Protestant?
Yeah, I was brought up, nominal Christian, Protestant, became a Muslim convert in university, and then returned to the Catholic faith into which I was baptized as an infant. Sure. So God's done quite a work in me.
Sure thing. Great. What's your question?
Yeah, but anyways, just really quick. I know we're running short on time. My question is this. St. Paul has a prohibition against, or an admonition against, men having long hair, saying it's against nature. But then in our popular statuary and iconography, both East and West, we find Jesus depicted with long hair. So I was just wondering, and especially the Shroud of Turin, I mean, there's a lot of scientific validity, in that whole thing. So I was wondering, how do we reconcile St. Paul's admonition with our popular iconography, statuary, and the Shroud of Turin image? And that's my question.
Right. And this comes in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. And that is where St. Paul is talking about the roles of men and women. Throughout in the letter to the Corinthians, Paul has to deal with a lot of issues related to sexual morality. Corinth was a port city in the western part of Greece, and it still is today. So merchant capital, people going in and out, a lot of different businesses, some more illicit and prurient, if you will. Different things that are going on for all the sailors passing in and out. And Paul was dealing with these things. In fact, in 1 Corinthians 5, he was dealing with a member of the congregation who was having relations with his own mother. I think it may have been his stepmother. He was having relations with his father's wife. And people weren't objecting to this stuff. They weren't objecting to it. And so he has to go. And in 1 Corinthians 6, he talks about the man betters and those who the terms essentially for homosexual behavior, going through trying to underscore the proper relationships between men and women and the proper roles for men and women. And so in 1 Corinthians 11:14, Paul is talking about both customs, like women covering their heads and how men should behave, but it goes back to our ultimate identities as men and women created in the image of God. So 1 Corinthians 11:14, he says, "Does not nature itself teach you that for a man to wear long hair is degrading to him, but if a woman has long hair, it is her pride, for her hair is giving to her as a covering." We have to be careful about the word long. What is long hair? If somebody watching in the 1950s, somebody might say that if your hair isn't as short as like Johnny Unitas or something, like a military buzz cut, you got long hair, you beatnik. But then when the hippies come around, it can be a little bit longer. For Middle Eastern customs, hair might be long going down over the ears. Some statues and depictions of Jesus, though, have long hair that's more reminiscent of later Roman styles or of later Renaissance styles, not what we would have seen in first century Palestine. But even there, like even if you had hair going down to your shoulder, that may not have been long in Jesus' time. Long hair might be like hair that goes to the middle of the back or down to the waist. And it's natural for women to be able to grow their hair. Many women, not the majority maybe, but a fair number are able to grow their hair to the middle of their back or down to the waist. But for men, they are not able to do that. So a man who is engaging in hairstyle or dress or anything to try to imitate women might be confusing his role as a man created in the image of God and something that degrades him, that he should let nature teach him how men are naturally ordered. So that might be, I would say, is one way to understand the passage. And thanks. And I'd like to say that we're thankful to hear how God has worked in your life also in your conversion. And yeah, I'd love to have you on the show or maybe my podcast, The Council of Trent. Would enjoy hearing about your story.
Thanks, Dustin. You cannot come on Catholic Answers Live and steal guests. That's not who told you that was acceptable?
Well, I can't we just borrow them like an exchange program?
I suppose that, yeah, we could probably have a foreign exchange. Yes. We can loan out Dustin to you. Say again where people can go to the podcast, because we're both wearing the podcast shirts.
We're both
today.
Wearing the shirt, yeah. If, the podcast is at TrentHornPodcast.com, or you can go to iTunes, Google Play to subscribe. But if you want premium content, go to TrentHornPodcast.com.
Thank you very much, Trent. And also, don't forget that our spring sale continues. Everything at shop.catholic.com, all books, CDs, DVDs, ebooks, tracks, and MP3s are 15% off if you put in the promo code SPRING18. Why did they pick 18? What's that all about? Well, I'll work on that. We'll see you tomorrow, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.